change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Nonprofit Snapcast. I'm your host, Mickey Desai. Very happy again to be speaking today with Chris Putnam Walkerly. Chris, how are you doing?
I am great, Mickey. How are you?
I'm doing great. We are going to get into the second half of your book again, Delusional Altruism. You know, in the first half of the book, you talked about the various delusions that people have in and around the philanthropic sector, in and around the nonprofit sector. And the second half talks about ways that they can transform giving in general. And I'm grateful for the opportunity, first of all, to be able to do this second half with you. I think this is going to be a good conversation. I wanted to ask you first, I noticed that on LinkedIn, the letters MSW follow your name.
Yes, they do.
How does a person with a social work degree get into being the philanthropic advisor to the stars? How did that happen?
Yeah, so that's right. So my entire career has been focused in the nonprofit sector, and I decided to get my master's in social work, thinking that I would become a nonprofit social service executive director, that I'd be running nonprofit organizations. But while in grad school, I took a couple classes in evaluation, program evaluation, that I really enjoyed. And I really appreciated the ability to assess and evaluate the impact of an intervention or a program or an organization for the purpose of improvements, you know, for the purpose of helping figure out what's working, what's not working, how do we make it better. And so that was very intriguing to me. And then I went to work. My first job out of grad school was at Stanford University in the School of Medicine. And I was working at a public health research center, and we were evaluating youth and gang violence prevention programs throughout California. And the whole thing was funded by one foundation, the California Wellness Foundation. And I became very intrigued by philanthropy at that junction, because I thought, you know, if you're a funder, if nothing else, you have money, you know, you have access to wealth, either your own or someone else's. But, you know, that doesn't guarantee success, right? You can't just throw money at problems. But if you do what they did, which was to, you know, bring in some of the best experts in the country to advise them on, you know, youth violence, how do you prevent youth violence, and what are the different strategies and interventions? What does the data show? What data don't exist that we should help fund? And so they really created a comprehensive 10-year effort to not just support young people in communities to get out of gang violence and stay out, but also to fund research on gun violence, to build leaders and leadership in the field, to kind of change policymaker opinion about really shifting from violence as a criminal justice problem to violence as a prevention, as a public health issue. Mm-hmm. So anyway, long story short, that made me intrigued about philanthropy. So I decided to go work at the David and Lucille Packard Foundation as my next job. And that at the time was the largest in the country, one of the largest in the world. And wow. I really learned a lot about strategic philanthropy and met a lot of people and decided I enjoyed giving money away effectively and started getting asked to do consulting projects on the side, really, and began doing some of those and discovered I liked consulting and, you know, and then decided to go off on my own. Now, you know, that was easy because I was in Silicon Valley. This was the dot-com boom. I joke that the way I got business was by answering my email and checking my voice messages because, you know, money was so bountiful.
Sure.
And, you know, people were trying to start foundations and, you know, their assets were growing. You know, they were trying to give their money away and they needed consultants. So that really launched my consulting career. And I've been doing this, you know, advising and consulting to philanthropists ever since for the past 20 years.
Right. That's amazing. An amazing journey. And it's clear that those perspectives have landed in this book, you know, how things must have changed since the dot-com boom to where we are now. In the first half of the book, you know, Delusional Altruism, we talked about all the wrong things that people are susceptible to, you know, things like, a culture of scarcity, being too fearful to do things with their money or to make an ask even. And then in the second half of the book, like I said, we're talking about transforming giving. And how is there a way to encapsulate that for people? How do we, I'm asking this because I think that transforming giving is sort of akin to asking people to transform their boards or to transform the culture of their organizations, right? How do you make people aware that a circumstance needs transforming anyway?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. So just to kind of give a big picture, quick overview, you know, delusional altruism is really about, you know, funders of all kinds, donors, foundation leaders, corporate giving programs, you know, genuinely want to make a difference and change the world, but are getting in their own way. And they're holding themselves back by a whole set of misguided beliefs and practices, like a scarcity mindset, like feeling too overwhelmed, like kind of putting in too many steps and too much clutter in their way, not having a strategy. And so I think, you know, to have a more transformational impact on whatever cause or issue you care about, I think part of the changes you need to make is to transform yourself and how you give as a funder, because I think how you give matters. And I think it matters, you know, almost as much as how much you give, because, you know, you could give away, let's just say, $25,000 to a nonprofit, and you could do that in a variety of ways. A more delusional way, I think, would be to spend, you know, 6 months trying to decide if you want to fund the nonprofit and then put in a lot of complex processes and applications and hoops that they have to go through. They probably, by the time they're done applying, they've spent $5,000 of their time to get the $25,000 grant. Meanwhile, it took so long, the talented staff person they wanted to hire to run this new program that you're funding has since taken another job because they couldn't wait 6 months to get hired, right? Now they're behind the eight ball trying to like scramble to find the new person. So, you know, you're really, you might think you're being thorough by offering conducting a lot of due diligence and being really thoughtful and putting all these expectations on the nonprofit to prove that they're effective and whatnot. But I think you're delusional because you're wasting time. You're wasting your own time. You're wasting the nonprofit's time, and you're causing the nonprofit that you're trying to help, that you're genuinely trying to help, you're causing them problems because they're not able to function. They're not able to plan. They're not able to hire because of all these processes you put in the way. But, you know, you could do that a different way. You could, you know, have a again, starting from, I want to give $25,000 to this nonprofit, have a conversation with them, understand what they're trying to accomplish, and say, give them a $25,000 general operating support grant that says, hey, we believe in what you're doing. You know, we have done some due diligence. We looked at your evaluation and we've talked to some of your funders, whatever it is. We've seen you in action. We trust you. We believe in you. Here's $25,000. We trust you.
Yeah.
You're the one doing the work.
Right, right.
We trust that you're going to use this well. And, you know, when this is all said and done, come back to us and let us know how it went. And in the meantime, if we can be helpful, give us a call.
Right.
That's what I mean by how you give matters, because that's the process and the mindset really that you're using. But the first example I gave was less effective. And the second example I gave, I think, is much more effective in achieving outcomes.
Okay. I'm thinking of a recent episode I did with Jamie Duffy, who wrote an open letter to philanthropists, to the philanthropic world in general. And her whole, the upshot of her message is basically move the money. You know, take away the bureaucracy and just let nonprofits do the thing that they need to do. And you know, especially with funders that you know already. And, you know, let's stop making nonprofits jump through hoops. If you trust them, let them do the thing they need to do. I think that both of you are on the same page in that regard. But at chapter eight, you know, you discuss starting with the right questions. And there's, I believe, 10 questions in here that you put down.
12, in fact.
12, did I miss? 12. Ah, yes, there it is. Of course, yes, I did miss it. So 12 questions, right? But does putting the questions in place further bureaucratize the situation? And this is my devil's advocate question. I kind of know the answer to the question already, but I wanted to toss that out there, right? Does putting the questions in place simply put up more speed bumps towards getting funded?
The answer is no, because I think it's too easy for funders to ask the wrong questions. And I think if you spend a little bit of time really thinking about the right questions to ask, and, you know, I don't mean to ask them all for the next, you know, 6 months, but you could ask them over time to yourself or check in on them on a regular basis, they actually will speed things up. So some of the questions I suggest people start with as a funder, I mean, the very first one is why, meaning ask yourself why to define and understand your purpose as a philanthropist. Why do you exist? Why do you want to, you know, give your money away? And also really to question assumptions, because a lot of times, you know, as a funder, you know, a lot of people are coming at you with ideas, best practices, needs, problems, opportunities, and they're encouraging you to fund them. And they're often important projects that need funding, right? But I think it's important to ask why, like, why should I fund this? Why is this the right fit for our strategy and things like that, to question the assumption. And those two questions, you know, asking why to understand your purpose and asking why to question assumptions, I think both can help you get that clarity that you need about what's your purpose, and not allow yourself to get distracted along the way as you're accomplishing your purpose. A couple other questions that I think are important that really speed things up is asking what, and asking in particular what before asking how. Meaning you have to know what you're trying to accomplish, the what, before you figure out how best to accomplish it, the how. And too often, people, we just jump into the how. Another way to think about this is focus on your strategy before focusing on your tactics. And too often, all of us, you know, we jump to tactics, right? Do we want to give large grants or small grants? You know, how often should our board meet? Should we, you know, fund general operating support or program support only? All these kinds of how questions. Should we be on Twitter or Instagram, right? And you can't possibly, the problem is you can't possibly know the right how. You can't possibly know how to accomplish something until you first clarify what you want to accomplish. And I think if you've ever been in a strategy session or a planning meeting where the conversation went around and around and around in circles with no resolution, and you felt like beating your head against a wall at the end of it, it probably was because people were talking about how to do something before gaining agreement on their objective, before clarifying the what. And again, I think, so once you know what you're trying to do, then you figure out how best to do it. And then you figure out what's, you know, what are the most important priorities for accomplishing that. That will speed things up because you and your family, you and your staff will all be aligned toward what's most important. Mm-hmm. Another question that speeds things up, I think, is asking yourself, what do we already know? Yeah. And because I think all of us know a heck of a lot more than we realize about whatever issue or problem we're trying to solve if we only allowed ourselves the space and time to think about it, to brainstorm, and, you know, take some notes and write it down. And by time, I mean like 2 hours, you know, if it's your staff meeting, your board, yourself, you know, you're sitting on your couch thinking about, you know, what am I trying to accomplish? Too often, I think we jump to looking to others to inform us. And I think in philanthropy, too often that means engaging in some kind of comprehensive data gathering exercise. You know, we're going to conduct a learning tour. We're going to interview all of our grantees. We're going to conduct an environmental scan, whatever it is. And I'm not against data and learning for sure. But I think if you start with what do we already know? What do we already know about the need for low-income housing in our community? You know, whatever issue you're focusing on. What do we already know about the importance of building leaders of color in the nonprofit sector? What do we already know about mental health challenges in our community? You might not be an expert in that, but you probably know either other things that are related or from your own personal experience or from your past experience making grants in these areas. You do know a lot. You probably also know, like, who are the experts to ask. And so I'm saying this because if you first just take a little bit of time to figure out what you already know, then you can figure out what don't we know. And that's another question, is what don't we know? Because, you know, you're brilliant, but you don't know everything. Right. As smart as you are. And so, but if you figure out the, you know, 50, 60, 80% of what you already know, then you can go after that smaller bit and you'll have much more clarity on what that is exactly. I was talking with a woman who was running a community foundation, and she wanted to engage in a planned giving campaign, but she didn't have any planned giving experience, quote unquote. And she said to me, like, who should I hire to help me figure this out? And I said, stop right there. The last thing you should do first is hire somebody, right? First, figure out what you already know about planned giving. And she didn't think she knew anything, but she had done a lot of other fundraising before. She had done a lot of communications work before. She had organized initiatives and other kinds of campaigns before. She'd engaged donors. You know, she knew a lot of stuff related to planned giving, right? So once we figured out what all that was, then we could go after the bits that she didn't know. Like, she didn't really know, how do you have a conversation about with someone about their death? You know, that's not an easy thing to do necessarily. So, you know, so there were things that she didn't know, but then she could figure out what those were and find the person that could help her with that. She didn't need help with the communications part of it.
Right.
She didn't need help with the creating an action plan. She needed help with the bits that she didn't know. So I think those questions really will ultimately help you speed things up.
You know, looking at the two questions that I had missed previously, what's the risk and does it bring you joy? My first question about what is the risk is, do you suppose that's why foundations and philanthropies are sticking with the old way of giving? I mean, is risk really a major concern in the giving process?
Yes, risk is interesting in philanthropy. I think, you know, one of the early chapters about delusion and the delusional part of the book is about funders feeling fearful. And that's in many ways what holds them back from taking risks, because they fear failure. They fear, you know, what happens if I invest in this and it doesn't work. And, you know, and really philanthropy is some of the best risk-taking capital there is, because, you know, philanthropic dollars are very flexible dollars. There's not the same kind of accountability of a government agency, for example, of federal or public dollars. And so, you know, philanthropy can actually take a lot of risks, which it should. It can be that R&D, that research and development arm of the field, right? And invest in kind of early ideas to test them and see if they work or don't work. And too often funders don't take risks. So I do encourage risk taking, but I also encourage funders taking prudent risk. And by that, I mean, you know, just because you have an idea doesn't mean it's a great idea. Just because someone comes up with an innovative approach doesn't mean it's the right approach. And I do think it's worth, if you're trying something new and innovative, or doing something risky, potentially risky, to kind of put it through some filters to see if it's a prudent risk worth taking. And those filters are very simple. They're things like, what's the cost and benefit of this? Like, literally, what's it going to cost? You know, what are the pros and the cons of doing this? Asking yourself, what's the ease of implementation? Like, if we might pull this off, but to actually implement it would be wildly expensive and probably take us completely off course, and it might not be worth it. Or what's the strategic fit? So just because it's a great idea doesn't necessarily mean it's a great idea for us to implement. Does this help us advance our strategy, or would it take us off course? And so I think it's important to just, again, take a little bit of time and really assess prudent risk and then move forward when you know, kind of what the risks are and you're willing to take them. And that's really important.
Okay. The next chapter. You see and act abundantly. We talked about the scarcity mindset before, and I like the saying you have at the top of this chapter, which is you have to spend money to make money, and that goes the same for philanthropy as well as it does in business. Do philanthropies act? I mean, again, devil's advocate question that I know the answer to already, but you know, philanthropies tend to have the money to spend. How does a philanthropy adopt a scarcity mindset when they're the ones that are giving away the money?
It's a really good question, right? We all equate wealth with abundance, right? Mm-hmm. But I think too often philanthropists have a scarcity mindset, and what they really need is an abundance mindset. And a scarcity mindset, just briefly, is really thinking about, you know, too often funders sort of believe that you have to maintain a Spartan operation, and that equates with delivering value into the community. So kind of the less we spend, somehow the greater the impact. Which doesn't really make any sense. And so, you know, nonprofits experience this when funders, you know, don't give them enough money to do what they really need to do, or fund them for the program, but not for the personnel to run the program, or, you know, simply don't provide enough overhead, which is important. You know, you need to fund the financial management systems. You need to fund the communication, the evaluation in order to be effective. And so they kind of hamstring the nonprofit by giving them, you know, almost but not quite enough money to do what they need to do, right. So that they have to scramble and piece together funding from all kinds of places and waste their time doing that. But often funders don't invest in themselves either. They don't invest in their own learning, their own knowledge building, their own good advising, coaching to help them be as strong as they can be. And I think funders really need to embrace an abundance mindset, which really means to a belief that the more you invest in yourself and your operation, the greater the impact you're going to have. And it doesn't necessarily have to be handing out money. It really is a mindset. And so an abundance mindset could be, I, the donor, I bring a heck of a lot more than money. I bring my knowledge, my insights, my professional experience and expertise, my experience having served on dozens of nonprofit boards,
right,
my conference room when, you know, we all can meet again in person, my connections to the community, the introductions I can make. So you bring a lot more, and that's an abundance mindset. How can I, what are all the ways I could help you, Mr. or Mrs. Nonprofit Leader,
right,
the work that you're doing? And so that's part of that mindset. I think also really having that courage to grow and develop yourself, to recognize, you know, that as brilliant as you are, you don't know everything and you need to learn, and you need to learn from other people who are different from you, and especially from the organizations and communities that you're trying to serve, to understand their needs and their perspectives and what they're experiencing, so that together you can create a better outcome for them. But, you know, also really like believing that you deserve the best. And I don't mean the best, you know, yacht or the best vacation.
Right.
But I mean, you do deserve, as the donor, you deserve the best talent. You deserve the best advising. You deserve the best systems. You know, funders, there's a lot of foundations that have not been investing in their own technology. And, you know, when the pandemic hit, they had no ability to make grants electronically.
Yes, I've heard that actually a number of different times.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, that's just an example where it isn't a major investment, but it's really, I think, based on fear, based on guilt,
mm-hmm,
and feeling like because you're a philanthropist, you don't deserve to invest in yourself, in your give, in the organization of your giving and the improvement of how you give, because somehow it's bad, right? Somehow you feel guilty.
Right.
And so you don't.
The money that you're spending on yourself is not money that you could put towards a program.
Exactly. But, right, you know, I'm not saying, you know, take your family to the Bahamas for your family foundation retreat, unless of course you're in the Bahamas. But I am saying, you know, invest in a family foundation retreat, you know, invest in bringing your family together and bringing a facilitator in, so that you can think and the facilitator can facilitate and help you,
yeah,
get clarity, create shared values, understand your strategy, get a game plan so that you can make the greatest difference possible.
Okay. Chapter 9, am I on the right number here? And I'm sorry, chapter 10, you are fast. It's in response to the idea that you're bogged down in various things that make the answering process go slow. You say a couple things in here that really resonate with me. The first one is, well, the first part of the chapter is good old fashioned time management. I think that's something I need to read over and over and over again. But the first thing that really resonated with me was the three ways to speed up your teams and your organizations. Think like a mechanic. I love that. but yeah, raise the hood and see what's going on, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think, you know, I think philanthropy moves too slowly in general. And the image I always conjure up is that of a sloth. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it moves too slowly, quite frankly, because it can, but I think there's lots of ways that we can speed things up, and we've seen funders speed things up, in 2020 for sure. So we know it can be done. But yeah, I think part of that is truly just lifting up the hood, if you will, of your own philanthropy. Think like a mechanic. A mechanic is looking at, you know, where's the blockage in the valves? You know, why is the engine not running smoothly? Like what's it? Why is there smoke? What's going on? Right.
Right. Right.
And why are the tires, you know, why is the car not moving fast? Oh, it's because the tires are low. So you really need to literally, I mean, all of us do, nonprofit leaders, business leaders, even families, you know, we need to lift up our own hoods and see like, where are the blockages? Where are we slowing things down?
Mm.
You know, again, the whole point of delusional altruism is not to be blaming and shaming. I don't think most people wake up in the morning and say, how can I make life harder for other people? Right.
Right.
This stuff happens just because it happens. And like suddenly it becomes the way things are done around here. You know, you start doing something, then you add a process, you add a system, you add an approval, you add a check, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And what used to take, you know, one person 10 minutes now takes a committee, you know, 10 weeks.
Yeah.
And it just, it's egregious. You know, just, it's like black mold. You know, it starts slowly in the corners of our offices and it suddenly it's taken over the building.
Right.
You know, right. One funder I was talking to, the foundation CEO started her job at an existing foundation and discovered that it took them on an average 9 months to make a grant.
Whoa.
9 months. And this is a fabulous foundation full of very talented people. You know, really, I know them. They're smart, they're trying to do the right thing. Again, none of them woke up in the morning and said, how do we make it harder for nonprofits to get money? It just is that because they looked at it, they lifted up their hood, if you will, and did a kind of an audit of their own practices and learned that just over time, the processes became elongated and, you know, more of them and more policies were put in place and no one was really paying attention. And so they began to remove them. And so I think part of that looking under the hood is just saying, well, you know, why do we require four people to approve a $5,000 grant and one person has to sign it twice? Or, you know, why don't we have online grant payment systems? Or why is it that no one in our organization knows what our strategy is? Because we don't have one. You know, why don't we have one?
Right, right.
Or, you know, I think people will be saying now, like, why do we have to come to the office at 8:30 every morning, right? So I think it's really important to take the time. And this is easier than you think. It doesn't have to be kind of a quote-unquote audit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, simply ask your team. You know, ask everyone in your team to come up with, like, one thing that annoys them, really, probably, that slows them down, that slows the plans down, and come up with a solution for improving it.
So my other silly question before I get onto the second part that resonated with me was, can a philanthropy hire a mechanic to help them dissect these things and take a better look at their stuff?
Yes, they can. I mean, there's consultants like me. I mean, I do this a lot for my clients to help them because it is helpful. It can be helpful to have an outside perspective because especially someone like myself who's worked with a wide variety of foundations, you can recognize that there's a lot of different ways to do things. And consultants can bring examples of their other clients to shed some light on different kinds of practice improvements and efficiencies so that you can make those changes. I mean, you know, one of my clients, just as an example, you know, she was the number two person at a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
That was her first foundation job. Her next foundation job, she becomes the CEO of a new foundation. The first foundation where she worked had a practice where everybody conducted site visits. They all conducted site visits with every applicant that like met some basic criteria. It was a big part of their culture. It was a big process. They involved their board, all of the staff. Yeah. It was a big to-do. She goes to her second foundation where she's one of like 1.5 staff people on a brand new board. And she thinks genuinely like she's supposed to conduct site visits with every applicant. And she's wondering how on earth she's going to pull that off.
Yeah.
With, you know, her and her like part-time bookkeeper and CFO or whatever. And what I said to her was, well, you don't. Like, you don't. There's no requirement. There's no law that says you have to conduct site visits. And she just didn't realize because her experience was that's what you do. And so it can be often very helpful to hire an outside expert. In fact, I'm hiring. I walk my talk. I'm hiring an outside expert to help me look at my own marketing strategies for someone else to kind of come in and do an audit, if you will, of like, what am I doing well? What am I not doing so well? And how can I improve? And mm-hmm. I think that's helpful for everyone. And that goes back to that abundance mindset, you know, believing that you deserve to invest in yourself so that you can have the greatest impact as
a funder. Right. Right. Exactly. The second thing that resonated with me in this chapter, which is when to go slow and when to go fast. So there are legitimately times that it's okay to take things a little slow. And the line, specific line that resonated with me was philanthropy can be a lot like dating. in my mind, the slow part is taking the time to really build the quality relationship, even though that seems sort of counterintuitive to getting the money to where it needs to be quickly.
Yes. I love dating analogies. They're so fun because everyone can relate to them.
Yes.
And so I use a lot of them. Yeah. So I think, you know, generally speaking, I think, you know, funders can speed things up. You know, if you can figure out how to do it in half the time, I think you're off to a good start.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely times where you need to go slow to go fast. And, you know, that's exactly what you said, building a relationship, you know, or when you just like dating. I'm sure we've all had the experience of like dating someone. And then there's like that voice inside you that says, run, or like, run, don't walk. Or, you know, that tells you like something isn't quite right. You need to pay attention to this. Like yes. Something is off. And so you need to slow down. You need to slow down the relationship and like check out your feelings and, you know, what's actually going on and deciding if this is the right fit or not. Similarly, I've had a lot of experiences with funders who had that funny feeling about grantees or about partners, you know, vendors mm-hmm. that were important partners. And, you know, they felt compelled to move quickly. And, you know, on paper, just like mm-hmm. with dating, you know, on paper, the grantee was the right fit. But there was something about them, you know, something that didn't rub them the wrong way. They just couldn't quite put their finger on it. And they basically like talked themselves out of it.
Right.
And pushed ahead, gave them the money and like, you know, engaged in the initiative, but it backfired because they were right. You know, it turns out trusting your intuition can actually be really helpful. And, right. And had they slowed down and really explored what was concerning them, they probably would have figured out what was not working, what was wrong, and, you know, found a different organization to work with or support. Because it ended up wasting a lot more time in the long run, right? Yeah. They funded the group. It didn't work out. Then they had to like extract themselves from the situation. That caused a lot of problems. And then the whole project was now behind, you know, 6 to 12 months because of that. So there are times, I do believe, and also especially if you're a funder where you're working in a new area, like within a community you don't have experience with. I'm working with a foundation right now where they're exploring, you know, funding a community that they mm-hmm. they believe that they really want to help and support, and they have very little experience. So we're taking it slow, and we're also figuring out like what do you already know and what don't you know, and who do you need to involve?
Right.
How do you engage with that community to learn from them and how you could best help them? And that takes a little time.
It does take time. Chapter 11: You Transform Lives. In many ways, this to me felt like the whole crux of the book, because isn't that why we're all in the business anyway, right? To be able to help make the world a better place, which in my mind is the process of transforming people's lives for the better along some dimension. But would you agree? Is this the crux of the book? Or I mean, maybe that's not a fair question to ask the author.
Yeah, it is the crux of the book, because I do believe, you know, if you're going to be a philanthropist, you know, you need to be in this because you want to create change. And the change, you know, really shouldn't be a band-aid solution. It should be, you know, transformational change, lasting change, so that, you know, someone's, you're not just helping someone, you're helping someone improve their life so that they don't need you anymore, you know, because they're off and running and they're doing just fine without you. And I think, you know, I think we all believe that on some fundamental level, but there's practices we can put into place or the ways in which we can fund things that I think really support that transformation.
Mm-hmm. This is somewhat a tangential topic at this point, but in my mind, the preferred state of what it means to be working as a nonprofit would be to become obsolete at some point. Does philanthropy sort of look at nonprofit work the same way? Is it, or look at social causes the same way? Are we trying to fund things well enough so that we can turn around in a year or two and say, okay, we solved that problem. What's next?
I think in theory, funders think that way. Mm-hmm. I don't know that in practice they always accomplish that. So, you know, I think there's things, and I mentioned this in the book, you know, not only do you need to more like fully fund the organization, like think about what the true costs are, the real costs of what you're trying to accomplish and how best to accomplish that. And in fact, there's some organizations, I'm probably gonna get the names wrong, but there's efforts among many funders to really support the full cost of nonprofits. There's, I think it's called the Full Cost Project, mm-hmm. which is a project of Philanthropy California. And Philanthropy California is a collaboration of the three regional associations in California: Northern California Grantmakers, Southern California Grantmakers, and San Diego Grantmakers. And they came together with some funding and some other organizations to really think about, you know, what are the full costs and how do you rethink your funding by thinking about the outcomes you're trying to accomplish and then what it's actually going to take to get to those outcomes. Right. And what that will cost. And that's the true cost, not, you know, the nonprofit coming to you with an unrealistic budget because they don't think you're going to give them enough money.
Right.
And they're trying to kind of lowball in hopes that you give them a grant. Like, that's just not the right way to accomplish the outcomes we seek.
Right.
So, and then also many large foundations, the Ford Foundation, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and others have also made pledges. The MacArthur Foundation, I believe, pledges to increase their funding for overhead for this purpose. So I think those are two really important points to make.
Right. There's a couple things in the chapter I wanted to try to touch on. I don't know if I'm going to be adequately wrapping my vocabulary around this, but the idea is that the philanthropies can actually rely upon their communities to drive innovation, that the philanthropy themselves don't have to drive innovation, that the answers sometimes come from the community. And I think that was a pretty huge thing to say.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there's two things in that. One is innovation, because, you know, that's one of those buzzwords that gets tossed around, I think. Most funders, I bet if you did an audit or a scan of every foundation grant guidelines in the world, the word innovation or innovative would pop up in like 75% of them. We fund innovative programs. We fund innovative leaders. We fund innovative ideas. But rarely do funders ever define what they mean by innovation. And rarely does anyone ever fund the development of innovative ideas. Like there's, I don't see very often like capacity building for innovation, right? So it's like this magical thing that is supposed to happen. Like, you know, the sticky notes of early childhood education, you know, like poof, it's supposed to like, you know, idea is supposed to come to you.
Right.
And funders rarely think of themselves as generating innovation. And I really counsel my clients on, you know, everyone can be innovative and it's not a special gene that you have. You don't need to be a quote unquote creative person to be innovative. You know, you really just need to think about, you know, make sure that the organization at the highest levels believes that everyone can generate innovative ideas. And you can kind of source innovations from all kinds of places, and you can build this into your practice so that you as the funder and the nonprofit and the community can kind of build that into their way of being, into their DNA, into their practice of generating and then testing innovative ideas so that you can adapt prudent risk, as I mentioned. But yes, absolutely. You know, we absolutely need to take the lead of communities and organizations led by people who represent those communities to guide our work as funders, because they're the ones, you know, living in the situation, both the challenges and the strengths that they bring and that the communities bring and have. That's my social worker in me, by the way. I really believe in a strength-based approach.
Yes.
To philanthropy and really focusing on people's strengths and building those strengths. But, you know, and I think there's increasing understanding and recognition of this for the past few years in philanthropy, and there needs to be more. And, you know, funders, you know, just need to get used to being uncomfortable and putting them, you know, allowing other people to help them understand what's actually going on, come up with ideas and recommendations, funding decisions, helping them to design their initiatives so that, because at the end of the day, again, at the end of the day, we're trying to transform lives and communities, right? So why not do that in a way that actually is going to do it?
Yeah.
And so a funder sitting in their own bubble is less likely to accomplish that than a funder who's deeply engaged with the communities they're trying to help.
Yeah.
And giving power to those communities as well.
Chapter 12, you are unstoppable. Some days I feel like some really bad dental work can just knock me out for an unspecified period of time. But I like the chapter, which again seems like a silly thing to tell the author, but if you've done all your homework, right, if you've done everything else that you've said in this book, if you've gotten a look under the hood, if you've answered the questions that you can up front, then that's power. That's completely an empowering thing for any organization, not just a philanthropy. What's the one thing you would hope a philanthropy takes home or realizes out of chapter 12, in that they are unstoppable?
You know, the one thing I would suggest that funders think about is really maintaining those adaptive and agility muscles that we've built this past year. You know, we all had to adapt to COVID by, if nothing else, figuring out how to work from home. as an example, or learning how to use Zoom on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. But also increase your agility. So adapting is responding to change that happens to you, and like, how do you respond to it? And how do you, you know, kind of pivot and use it to your advantage? Being agile is really looking ahead and looking out into the, you know, the near future to say, like, what are the changes that are coming? What are the likely scenarios? How do we either navigate around them or use them to our advantage and like kind of take them and like lasso them and use them to help us or create new innovative ideas? And so I think especially as, you know, change is inevitable, right? Disruption and volatility are the status quo.
Yeah.
Like, as we all get vaccinated and things will get better, that doesn't mean change is going to stop. Like, change right. will continue to happen. And so I think we need to kind of get, like, lean into that and, like, breathe into that and recognize that that's okay, that's real, and we need to get really good at being agile. And I write about this in a guide that I think your listeners might want to download. It's called mm-hmm. 8 Things Every Philanthropist Can Do yes. to Change the World, even when the world keeps changing. And you can just go to 8things.org and download it. It's for free, 8things.org. And it really talks about the importance of, you know, creating a plan that you can count on, even while conditions all around us keep changing. And to do that, again, it's having clarity. It's kind of shifting your mindset and saying, okay, well, things are never going to be quote unquote normal or calm. Change is always going to be happening.
Right.
That's okay. Let's create a plan, but let's assume that things are going to change along the way. Let's assume that either externally in our community or in the policy environment or internally in our organizations, our families, things are going to change. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to change and course correct along the way and actually build time in, like literally in the next year, like block out, you know, 2-hour blocks of time every 2 months where you're going to check in on your plan. Ask yourself, what's changing? Do we need to adapt or change based on what's going on? And then do that. And so that you always have a clear strategy, a clear plan that's guiding your decision making that is really always present and organic and sentient and, you know, living and breathing to guide you. And so I really think that if I could, you know, that makes you unstoppable because sure. you have clarity of what you're doing and the confidence that you can make changes along the way, so that you're always focused on what's most important.
You're talking about the North Star that you mentioned in chapter 13, the actual adoption of a strategy, or actually the nimble adoption of a strategy. Maybe that's the right adjective string to put in front of that. But in other words, know where you are, know where you're going, and try to speedily get there. Is that a correct summation?
That's a very good summation. I really talk about, you know, one of my offerings is called Sentient Strategy. And that's really about how strategy needs to be, you know, alive and thinking and organic mm-hmm. and living, breathing. And so, you know, I think the old way of doing strategy development or strategic planning is to, you know, envision this like 18-month process, right? Mm. And first you have to like spend 3 months coming up with a RFP to hire a consultant. And then you finally get that person hired. And then you've now created a year-long process where you're engaging your board and you're doing all this data gathering and you're collecting all this data and you're stopping your grant making often in the meantime, and you're gathering all this information that then completely overwhelms you, by the way, again. Right. And then somehow you magically come up with a strategic plan that you probably could have figured out, you know, 9.5 months prior mm-hmm. if you just allowed yourself to. And then, but wait, there's more. Then you have your strategy, but now it has to be beautifully written up into a lovely document. Mm-hmm. Right? It includes the history of the foundation and like your theory of change and all this stuff, right? Infographics. Right. Then you need a graphic designer to make it really pretty. And then a communications plan, right? Mm-hmm. Then your board hasn't quite officially approved it yet, but they're not meeting for the next 2 months at your quarterly board meeting. So then the whole thing is postponed for approval until then. So now it's like 2 years, like right. 2 years and like $150,000, or, you know, I know a foundation that's currently spending $320,000 doing this.
My goodness.
Right. Meanwhile, what have you been doing for the past year and a half, right? You've still been paying your staff. So they've been operating absent a strategy. Your board's been operating absent a strategy, and your grant making has been on hold. So you haven't been helping anybody. To me, it's just a stunning lack of clarity and a lack of like reality check. And funders are just not, you know, recognizing the amount of money they're wasting, the amount of time they're wasting, and how that's preventing them from achieving the impact that they seek.
Right.
And so, you know, to me, strategy can be done quickly. It's clarifying, you know, what are you trying to accomplish in a year? Because I don't think you can really plan out more than a year ahead at this point. Where are you today? And what are the things you need to focus on to get you from where you are today to where you want to be?
Yeah.
And that's your strategy. And you can do that in a day. I do this with my clients in a day. I do it, or, you know, give yourself a couple of weeks if you must.
Yep.
But, you know, that also requires you to be gathering data all the time. You know, so, you know, if you don't know anything, I mean, I suppose if you're starting out, you might want to do a little bit of research, but it shouldn't be months and months.
Right, right. I mean, I like that point that I want to underline over and over again, that this is not rockets. Well, I shouldn't say that. I might have to edit that out. But this is not an overly complex process, right? It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be a major undertaking. It could be a pretty quick one.
Yeah, I think, you know, too often funders complexify the simple, and they need to simplify the complex. And so, yes, I think, you know, if your belief is we're creating a plan for the next 5 years, and we need to spend a year doing that, so that it's like, so we, it's kind of like a, it's a, I think it's based in fear. It's, yeah. It's sort of like we need to prove that we did all the due diligence. We need to prove that we talked to all the people. We need to prove that we looked at all the data so that we can justify why this is our strategy, which, by the way, it's your right. I mean, it's your foundation. You can create the strategy that you believe in. And again, chances are it's not going to end up wildly off what you would have come up with on your own anyway.
Right.
So I think it's this need to justify yourself. And then so that it can somehow last for 5 years, which is not possible anyway, because things are going to change.
Exactly.
And then the funder kind of marches in lockstep to accomplish that plan, not recognizing that what they need to be doing, I think, is instead just doing this on an annual basis.
Yep.
Take a couple days, refresh your strategy, regularly kind of, you know, be collecting data. So, you know, you should understand what's going on in your community. You should be tracking trends and talking to grantees and building relationships along the way.
Right.
So that when the year's up and you're refreshing the strategy, you are already informed and you have that data and insight and information. And sure, if you want to engage other people's perspectives, then do that. But you don't need to spend 6 months doing that.
Right. The part that stuck with me in this chapter was communicating these new directions, the new strategic priorities directly to your recipients in person, which ties into the whole effort to just be genuine, be who you are, but be forthright about who you are and the changes that may come along the way. You know, breaking the news in person and providing bridge grants in particular are the two things that landed on my head, that you're not just cutting people loose, right? You still have a relationship and you still want to help folks, but if your strategy changes, again, be genuine about communicating that to your recipients and then help them move on a little bit if necessary.
Exactly. I think nothing strikes fear in the heart of grantees than a funder saying we're about to embark on strategic planning. Because often what happens is, A, it's a really long process during which they have no idea what's going on and they're just fearful that they're going to lose their funding.
Right.
But, you know, I think if no matter what, you engage and let your grantees know, you know, just because you don't have all the answers yet doesn't mean you can't communicate about what you're doing.
Yep.
And just let them know this is our process. This is our timeline. This is what we're thinking. We want to keep you appraised of what's going on. Feel free to contact us at any time. And, you know, if your strategy does change dramatically and some of the organizations you've been supporting in the past, you're no longer going to support.
Yep.
I think it's very kind to offer what I call bridge grants. And we did this. I was consulting with Charles and Helen Schwab's Family Foundation. And they were, you know, shifting from being a more responsive grant maker funding in a wide variety of areas to really narrowing down to three areas of focus. So consequently, they were nonprofits that are doing great work that just didn't fit the new guidelines. But what we did is we came up with bridge grants and we basically gave them another year of funding at about the same level they had been receiving. And we made it general operating support grants so they could use the money however they wanted, including, you know, what that could have included getting fund development help so they could raise more money. And we gave them a year, you know, so that a year notice that the funding was going to go away and funding to stay afloat. And that, to me, that's very helpful. It's very kind. And, you know, again, if you believed in that nonprofit last year under your last strategy, you should still believe in them, even if you're not, if they're not aligned with what you're trying to accomplish.
Right. And I imagine that there's room to actually say, look, we won't be funding your initiative in this way, but let me introduce you to someone else who might. Does that kind of thing happen?
Yeah, I think that's a great role that funders can play. And I think nonprofit leaders should recognize that that's a way that your funders can help you, even if they're your current funders. You know, philanthropists know other philanthropists. They go to conferences or virtual events. They meet other people in the community or around the country and even around the world. And so, yes, as a funder, I think it's great to introduce grantees to other funders. Or, you know, often as a funder, you have a bird's eye perspective on what's happening in that field. And so to help them see, you know, resources or organizations or best practices that they might not realize is a true value that you can provide that's, you know, clearly with no cost. Again, that's that abundance mindset, thinking about how else can I add value and help this nonprofit.
Right. Chapter 14, you do what it takes, a nice four-step, I want to call it a reminder. I don't know if that's the right word to use, but a nice summary of helping people stay nimble and helping them stay on top of the directions that they've chosen. Is that accurate?
Yeah. You know, chapter 14 is really all, or yeah, 14 is all about strategy implementation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really strategy fails in its implementation, not its formulation. So as much effort as you might have taken to create your strategy, the harder part is actually getting the darn thing to work.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is people don't have clarity on their top priorities for implementing their strategy, and they don't have clarity on who's accountable for what. And I really believe that the critical moment for this to take place is the last hour or half of your strategic planning session. Mm-hmm. So when I facilitate strategic planning with my clients, it includes, you know, you create your strategy, but then you talk about, well, what are the top priorities, right? You probably have like 26 or 62 things that you think have to happen next, but you can't have 60 priorities, right? You could have maybe three as an organization. So what are those top priorities? What are those critical things that have to happen next in order for your strategy to be implemented? That doesn't mean you're not going to get to the other things, but what are those first things? And I would pick three, maybe four tops. And then identify people to be accountable for implementing each of them. I call them priority champions. So you literally assign a human being to each priority. And
that's brilliant. Yeah.
They're tasked with, but before you leave the room, before you leave the strategy session, you know, at least initially coming up with their like checklist, like what are the next 5 to 10 things they're going to do to begin to implement that strategy, that piece, that priority. That could involve who else needs to be involved. What are the data do you need? Whatever it is, right? But come up with that list. And by when are we all going to meet again to check in on progress? So that your priority champions walk out the door. Everyone knows what the top priorities are. Everyone knows who's responsible for what. They walk out the door with their marching orders. They don't need to create like a Gantt chart or a complex work plan. I'm talking a list. What are the 5 or 10 things I have to do next? They need to block out time in their calendar to make them happen, so that they can at least think about them.
Yep.
And then there needs to be a date, a time, a date on the calendar for everyone to reconvene where everyone's going to come back and say, great, priority champion one, what progress have you made? What challenges are you having? How can we help you? Who else needs to be involved?
Right.
And the reason this is so important is because by the time you've created your strategy, everyone's so exhausted, right? They've, you know, because they probably spent way too much time creating the strategy in the first place, one of my clients. But, you know, and so you're exhausted. You finish the strategy. Hurrah, we did it. That's awesome. You go back to your office, back to your laptop, back to your calendar, your inbox, and you get sucked back in to all of those, like, right, your inbox, your other priorities, your other deadlines, all that stuff on your calendar. And you immediately, like, forget, like, your new strategy, like, gets tossed, you know, to the back burner. And you just get sucked into all this other stuff. And then like a month later, everyone looks up and says, wait, what were we supposed to do? And so, you know, so truly, if you just in that moment, like get that clarity, who's responsible for what and by when, that person doesn't have to do all the work. They just need to make sure the work gets done and they can report on progress so that there's like a momentum. You know, your strategy is immediately being implemented starting the next day. You're not waiting, you know, 6 months for someone to graphically design your strategic plan.
Yep. Yep. What I do have done in the past is I've also literally set a timer. There's a couple of timer type things that remind you when to stand up and go walk around. And I've actually used one of those to say, okay, you're only allowed to check your email between these intervals right here and don't get bogged down in the rest. Good stuff. Chapter 15, you bring everybody home again, I think. It's sort of like gathering the herd and then also opening the gate. Now that you've learned all this stuff, here you go, enter the world and do the good work you're supposed to do. There was a thing in here that stuck out to me. The 2 points that you make are learn from your grantees, which we've talked about a little bit already, and then don't go it alone. That to me is huge. Can we talk a little bit more about that? Because I don't think you and I have actually addressed that in this conversation today.
Yeah. In the last chapter, I really encourage readers to, pick like one thing that they've learned from the book and really make a lot of progress on it, because you might've learned lots of things you want to improve, but again, it's hard to improve everything at once, but like pick one or two things, either the most important thing or that low hanging fruit thing that you can do quickly and really move on it. But if there are changes that you want to make, you know, that are kind of big changes and transformational changes, I really do think we all need help. You know, we all need help doing them. And so, you know, that's my role as an advisor, as a consultant to philanthropists, is to help them either be that sounding board so that they're not so alone in making their decisions, to give them that different perspective, to help them facilitate the planning and the changes they want to make, to create that action plan, to create the strategic plan. You know, I mean, everyone can probably facilitate their own meetings, but isn't it better to be the thinking partner, the person thinking and reflecting in the room, and somebody else is doing the heavy lifting of that facilitation, for example? Right. But, you know, I think if it's a nonprofit coach, if it is getting someone who can help you with fund development as a nonprofit, if it is, you know, you want to launch a podcast, you know, why not turn to someone with expertise and, you know, running podcasts to help you as opposed to making it up on your own, right?
Right, right.
All of us need help and guidance. And I think it's really important to invest in ourselves, embrace that abundance mindset, and get the help that you need to accomplish the goals that you want.
It's a good recipe for life in general, not just for philanthropic giving, but that's brilliant. Chris, I love this. I'm advising everyone I know to read the book and get the book. And I hope we get to do more of these conversations again in the future. This has been a real joy for me. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. And I encourage folks to, again, order the book, Delusional Altruism, and that guide I mentioned earlier, 8 things every philanthropist can do to change the world, even when the world keeps changing, also provides some really practical tips to create a plan you can count on.
Yep.
And you can go to 8things.org and download that for free.
8things.org. And once again, the website for the book is delusionalaltruism. Is it .com?
Yes.
Got it. Chris, thanks again. Thanks for making this recording with me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Nonprofit Snapcast. I value your feedback via the Nonprofit Snapcast website. That's nonprofitsnapcast.org. I would welcome the opportunity to tell you more about my consulting services. Visit nonprofitsnapshot.org and click on the consulting tab to learn more about the work that I do with nonprofits across the country.
This has been the Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.